Hi, I'm Phoebe Lovett, and this is Deep Read, a podcast where I have conversations with big thinkers about big ideas. Every episode is accompanied by a further reading list, which you can find at phoebe.substack.com. And if you enjoy the podcast, please like, subscribe, and share it with a friend. Thank you for listening. My guest today is Mindy Sue, designer, professor, researcher, and editor of Cyberfeminism Index, in which, quote, hackers, scholars, artists, and activists of all regions, races, and sexual orientations consider how humans might reconstruct themselves by way of technology. Featuring more than 700 short entries of multimedia activism, the index is a rich resource for anyone interested in technology, feminism, and the intersection between the two. After the book was recommended by New York City publicist Gia Kwan on a previous episode of this very podcast, I knew I wanted to speak more with Mindy about her broad range of interests and ideas, and our conversation didn't disappoint. In the interview that follows, we covered everything from publishing as an art practice to TikTok restocking videos to the etymology of the word ergonomic and so much more. I hope you enjoy it. Good morning, Mindy.
Hi, Phoebe. What time is it over there?
It's 5:08 p.m. London time. And I think you said you're in L.A., right?
Yes, 9:08 a.m. L.A. time. So good afternoon for you, yeah.
Bright and early. Thank you so much for making the time.
Of course. Happy to chat.
You're in L.A. teaching, is that correct?
Yeah, I just moved out here from New York. I have a new position at UCLA, so I'm actually going to have a bit of a bi-coastal situation for the next couple of years. So I'm here till June, and then I'll go back to New York for 6 months, and hopefully it's the best of both worlds.
I mean, I think it's being in LA in January versus New York is probably not the worst of worlds. I feel like having lived in both places, LA really comes into its own at this time of year, no?
I really think so. It's really unusual to be sitting in like a 65 degree blue sky. It's beautiful outside. Though that said, it seems like it's not so cold in New York right now either. Their weather is more volatile, but global warming is really making an impact. It's been a very warm winter over there.
Yeah, this has been a recurrent theme in my interviews recently because I'm mostly speaking to people who are either in London, New York, or LA. And people in LA are always commenting on how climate's changed there. And then people in New York are often saying that it's actually not so cold there. So it's like it's all just getting mixed up. And I think it's having quite a big impact on the way that people's lives pan out there. I know that LA last year had an awful winter and it was freezing for months and raining, which I think threw the residents off massively.
And I think we're still kind of in an El Nino season. It's been raining quite a bit. It's not super cold, but I also run hot, so I'm less sensitive to it. But absolutely, everything's getting turned upside down.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you're teaching at UCLA, is that right?
Yes, in the Design Media Arts Department.
Is that your on-gathering course?
Yeah, the name has changed. I have an MFA seminar that's now called Performing Lectures about the lecture performance. But it really does think about different forms of presentation and output and how we can kind of blur these code switching moments that we tend to have.
When you say code switching, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that when we think about a lecture, there are natural conventions. You have a quote unquote expert standing on a stage behind a podium with like a big projection, and the audience is in amphitheater seating. So that's a conventional lecture format. But there are so many other ways of relaying something while really challenging what those conventions are. So as long as you're saying something somewhat informative, which is the lecture part, then we can really focus on novel presentation. This can be using an unusual tool. This can be making the audience sit in a circle. This can be putting on a character. And that also makes us question what performance actually is, because the way I'm talking to you now is different than the way I'm talking to my best friend or talking to my parents, talking to my students. So we naturally put on these different guises, and it's just trying to tap into those kind of intentionally.
And when you say, because when I initially asked you, are you teaching on gathering, you kind of said no, but it's almost in a different guise. Like, how do you see, I mean, just for a bit of context, could you explain what the on gathering course you were teaching was about? Because I felt like it was such an interesting entry point to talking about cyberfeminism index. And
for sure. Yeah. So on gathering was a course that I was teaching at Yale, also for the MFA students in the School of Art. That class was really trying to think about the politics of collection, how we naturally kind of collect all of these resources specifically for your kin or community. And then also thinking about how its presentation is also a form of gathering. So how can you activate that collection or archive? So material gathering followed by a social gathering. But the reason why I changed it is actually because Yale and Rutgers were on a semester schedule, 16 weeks. Then UCLA is on a quarter schedule, which is 9 to 10 weeks. So there's just not enough time to get through both chapters, let's say. So I just whittled it down and focused on the presentation part.
Yeah, because I was having it. I mean, I love the way that you present your personal website. It's so like thorough and there's so much to
Crossback style.
I loved it. I was really just like deep diving on it. And you linked to this, I think you linked to the syllabus. So I was like having a look at how you structure that course. And from what I could understand, a lot of it was what you were saying, like about, you know, not only coming up with a concept or an idea, but then finding interesting ways to, as you put it, perform it or bring it to life, like create some kind of like physical component to the idea as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much.
So I think I understand it, but yeah, great website, really very straightforward and like logical, but also like, I don't know. I'm like, why don't more people do their websites like this? I think we've gotten lost. Good reference for everyone. So speaking of, yeah, the gathering concept. So from what I understand, and again, I've really learned a lot from like, because I bought the Cyberfeminism Index after it was recommended by Gia.
Oh, on another, thank you.
I'd obviously seen it on the internet. It's, you know, very distinctive book, but I was, you know, obviously trying to get a bit more context for it to understand it. I think I thought I had an idea of what cyberfeminism meant and then realized maybe I didn't, or certainly there was a lot more like layered and multifaceted or nebulous, I think you've described it as, than perhaps I understood it. I know you kind of resist a singular definition of cyberfeminism. So I was just wondering more so if you could explain why you think it's important or why it's worthy of putting together a book, like why do we need to know about cyberfeminism in this moment?
Yeah, I think that is something that me and my collaborators, the publisher and co-designers and et cetera, we've really been thinking about why cyberfeminism might be relevant now, because the term itself feels a bit retrograde. This also kind of relates to my website design, right? Like that style, prof doc, coined by Olia Lialina, was really like a very simple HTML format that professor doctors would use in the 90s, because it was such an easy way of publishing a website and allowed for very easy maintenance. And a lot of these 90s style websites, of course, are very present in the book and in the online index. But topically, I think it's especially relevant because it's really kind of a field's guide for people who use the internet now, which is a lot of people. About 65% of the global population are active internet users. That's also important to note that that means 35% are not active internet users. And that's quite a big number as well. So trying to also push away from this idea.
Yeah, a lot higher than I think, a lot higher than a lot of people I think would estimate if you ask them how many people are online. Like to know that actually 35% of the world's population aren't is, it's somewhat mind-boggling for us. Very like...
For sure. We think the internet is the entire world, and we think all the information on the internet is all the information in history, and that's just really not the case. But I think when talking to students, I've been in the creative computation, critical code world for many years, and I really found that there were artist friends making experimental media art pieces. I had lawyer friends focusing on different forms of internet policy and legislation, and a whole mix of other people that were thinking about the same themes, but there didn't seem to be much overlap between them. So I thought the Cyberfeminism Index would be a nice way of bridging together all of these things. Whether you're working on a syllabus or you're an artist, you're a policymaker, you're a coder or a hacker, et cetera, or you're just like an Instagram user, then this book would actually reveal a lot of different ways that you can start to think critically about the tools that we're using instead of just using them in the way that they were designed.
And just to rewind a little bit for someone who, you know, as I said, I sort of came to this interview with what I thought was an understanding of cyberfeminism, one that I've, you know, since expanded considerably. But for people who've got no context for it, from what I understand, it's kind of a movement or an approach that kind of, I think, would I be correct in saying that most people would attribute it to starting with Donna Haraway's A Cyborg Manifesto? Is that kind of seen as like the genesis of the movement, or is that a misunderstanding on my part?
Yeah, I think that the Cyborg Manifesto was really important because it was starting to introduce like cyborgian theory, but the term itself was actually coined by two distinct groups, unbeknownst to the other, the Australian art collective VNS Matrix and the British cultural theorist Sadie Plant. So this happened in the early 90s, and it was almost a pushback of a lot of the science fiction that was coming out in the 80s, like William Gibson's Neuromancer. So Neuromancer kind of predicted these sensory networked online landscapes that we're very much talking about and using today. But it was also very characterized by a very male gaze. You have fembots and cyber babes and depictions of women as robots or assistants. So I think this was a way to reclaim that with a lot of humor and a lot of provocative language. And then because they didn't put clear boundaries intentionally, it kind of spiraled into all of these different instantiations around the world. So you have like hack feministas in Latin America or net femis in Korea or a bunch of contemporary examples. But then it starts to feel like the mutation is actually part of the goal. It's about this blend of net art, online activism, media art, any media that you want. But there is a very intentional criticism of technology while also being very tech proficient.
I love that the actual terminology kind of arose like two different, or one woman and one group in tandem had like named it at the same time, unbeknownst to each other. I think it's very apt, isn't it, the entire thing, that they both kind of like plucked down this idea from the ether and like used it as a way to name and categorize all these ideas they were having.
Yeah, it seems like it was really ripe for that time, because I mentioned Neuromancer earlier because that was the first time cyberspace was used. So I think that's where they got this prefix cyber, and then they attached it to feminism, and that was also changing around the world. But I guess now people actually might call it technofeminism, which was coined by Judy Wiseman. But I kind of prefer cyberfeminism because it points back to its origins. But again, everyone uses different names. It's meant to be kind of this imperfect umbrella term that just pulls together similar themes.
Yeah. And so at the time, I mean, it's kind of, even though it was only, what are we talking, 30 years ago-ish?
30 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It seems almost quaint to think that Not that any of this thinking is quaint. Cyberfeminism is not what I describe as a quaint methodology or approach by any means. But the internet has become such a dystopian place that the idea that there were people around the world who are seeing it, you know, as a potential utopia and like a way of overcoming the patriarchy or overthrowing the patriarchy or, you know, dispensing with gender construct or achieving liberation, like the idea that these were the kind of things that the internet symbolized just feels so alien to where we're at with the internet now, where it's, you know, people talk about it as like a hellscape and a hell site, and everyone's got a really, I mean, I say everyone, I'm generalizing again, 35% of the world's population not even online. So I'm talking, you know, from my like my little padded Western perspective, but it just seems like this very dystopian place that we're all trying to find ways to escape from or detox from or, you know, retreat from in different ways. People go to great lengths now to try and stop themselves from being online. It just is such an interesting, in a relatively short space of time, to go from like these ideals that cyberfeminism arose from to where we're at now. I mean, I don't even know what my question is here. I just can't stop. It feels such a sharp decline. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that's also pointing towards like the acceleration of the space, because a lot of the things that kind of defined or pointed at these utopian principles, like global connectivity, or the ability to find people online, the ability to be an avatar and perform online that's different than your physical life. All of these things have been accelerated to such an nth degree that now it's become highly commodified. And that also maps to the different waves that the internet itself has had. So when cyberfeminism was coined, that was Web 1.0. And now we hear all this talk about Web 3. So because we're already like three generations in, I think that also points to why, of course, the landscape is going to change. But maybe the biggest shift was in like late Web 2.0, when we have all these platform oligopolies emerge. So suddenly this like free-for-all that we're seeing ended up becoming heavily templatized, heavily commodified. And the people who are actively using the online spaces, all of that suddenly just became for sale or meant for data extraction and advertising. So I think this is where we really start to see a very sharp shift. But that said, you can find like weirdo subcultures online. It's just not on your mainstream platforms.
For sure, for sure. And I guess, you know, what we're also seeing is the imbalance of the masculine energy, for want of a better word, within the cyberspace as it exists now. That's why I found the On Gathering course so interesting. And then the original text that you refer to, which is, what's the name of it? The carrier bag theory of fiction.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about that? Because that's just, again, I know you've sort of moved on from talking about the course itself, but that as an explainer for like how all these utopian possibilities of a networked world through the internet have been not, as you say, they still exist in micro communities, etc. But like largely we've moved away from that narrative, and actually maybe it's reflective of the fact that from the very jump, we've sort of misunderstood technology. I don't know. Tell me more about that text, please, in your own words, because I find it really fascinating.
Yeah, I think it's less about a misunderstanding of technology, but more so like how the histories of these technologies are often told. I really love that essay. It's kind of like a chapbook by Ursula K. Le Guin from the 80s. So the carrier bag theory of fiction, she posits that the first tool was not actually the spear, which is a tool of dominance, but rather the basket, which is a tool of gathering and a tool of communion. So this does a couple things. It reframes our history of technology, right? It expands it towards analog tools, not just the digital connotation that it currently has. It also makes it way more communal focused rather than individual focused. And that then shifts the protagonist away from this individual male hero that we typically have in our history books towards a collective, from a he to a we. Not to mention there's a highly gendered component too. In mainstream understanding, the gatherers were women and the hunters were men. So I think it does this short book does so much to really turn that history on its head. So it was this kind of idea that I was employing for the on-gathering class. So the material gathering is, what are the disparate elements that you're bringing together? That's really a curatorial exercise. What is the basket itself? What are the different mechanisms for how you display that collection? And then how do you activate it? What is the social gathering for all of these things that you've brought together? So it's really communal driven.
It reminds me, reading about that, reminding me of this. I think we have a mutual friend in Martine Sims, the brilliant Martine Sims. And she, I read an interview with her on a book that I'd bought not long ago called Publishing as Practice, where she was talking about print publishing as sort of like art practice. And I'm going to paraphrase her now, but there's something like, publishing is how we make ideas public, and in doing so, we make public around the ideas. Like that idea that you can, which I feel like, I mean, again, I'm not, disclaimer, both you and Martine are operating on an intellectual level that's at times takes me a while to unpick. But from what I understand, like that's a crossover in your work of like trying to make these physical manifestations of these very like deeply layered ideas that you have. Is that correct? Did I get that right?
No, it's so nice to hear Martine, even if you were paraphrasing, it's so nice to hear Martine's adaptation of that quote, because if you think about the root of publishing or publication, the root word, it really is public. So there have been a lot of people that kind of write and talk about this idea. Like Michael Warner said, a publication is where a public is formed, right? Like you're writing for a specific group of people, or people read it, it resonates, and it builds some sort of public or dialogue. And then like André Breton said, to publish is to find comrades, right? It's, people always think that writing is like the solitary act, which in many ways it is, but it's really meant to be broadcast and shared and find like-minded people. So I definitely think that Martine is really thinking about these things too. And I love that overlap.
And I think, I mean, she's just so brilliant. I love talking to Martine. And I think also, you know, from what I understand, there's also a distinction for you between publishing online and publishing, you know, physical objects, as you've done with the Cyberfeminism Index. You know, when you look through it, I know it started as a Google sheet and it exists online as well. And in many ways, it feels like a website in print. And like, but that, all of that is deliberate on your part, from what I understand. Like you wanted it to be a physical object, even though it could have just as easily continued to exist online, because as someone with a deep understanding of archives and their importance, like this kind of misconception we have that everything that's online will always be online forever and ever is problematic in a lot of ways, because as anyone knows, like I used to do a lot of journalism in my early 20s, and sometimes I go back and try and find it, and of course it's all gone. You know, like, and I didn't think to keep an archive of it for myself at the time. I wonder about the longer term implications of that for so much culture that's being generated in the present moment. Obviously, I'm a bit biased towards print media, print publishing. I love books, but I think for all sorts of artistic mediums, the fact that so much of our output right now only exists in digital spaces and largely on platforms where we don't even own our own content.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I wonder, well, first of all, I will say I also really love books. Like this is maybe the superficial reason why we wanted to do a print book in the first place. But to your point about how the internet saves everything, as you're witnessing in real time, that's really not the case. And even if it is, inundation might be the biggest form of erasure just because we have this huge information overload. Even if it is still online, that doesn't mean we can access it. For those articles that you wrote in your late 20s, though, I wonder if they might actually be archived on the Wayback Machine.
Oh, yeah, they probably are.
Yeah, if you search in like the name of the journal, it might actually have saved some of the plain text. So I might check there.
I mean, to be clear, that they're not necessarily things that warrant like downloading whatever, printing out. I think I came across a term in one of your interviews, link rot. You know, just this idea that even just the fact that like I have, you know, God knows how many thousands of photos in the cloud. And to me, that means they're safe. But of course, like nothing could be further than the truth. All it takes is for whatever, I don't know, I'm not technical enough to know server error exactly, you know, to happen. Just as like when we were setting up this interview, I was like, okay, well, there was something about the server coming up in my browser window. And I was like, well, I can't argue with the server. If the server won't let us do this interview, I'm powerless to it, right? The interview might not happen. Luckily, we managed to figure it out. But I have photos from previous iPhones uploaded into Dropbox. And again, that to me is like me safeguarding them. And it's just such when I say it out loud, I'm like, it's such a delusional concept that I'm just allowing Dropbox to safeguard my memories from the last 10 years. And actually thinking that I'm being quite organized by having them there.
But I think this is kind of that is the safety measure that they want us to believe. And in many ways, I do this too. I think if you talk to digital archivists, they will tell you that duplication is key. And this is quite unique to the digital archiving space because you can't duplicate analog objects for physical archives. So even like the Internet Archive, which runs the Wayback Machine, they have one huge server farm in the Bay Area in California. They have one huge server farm where the former Library of Alexandria used to be, which is what they were influenced by. And they have one server farm in an undisclosed country because they want to make sure no one really knows where it is and it stays safeguarded. So while Dropbox and Google and et cetera also have these duplications, even the other day, Google had an outage and I couldn't access my Google Docs. And I really felt like, wow, I have so much work locked up on these clouds. Even if it's just an outage for 30 minutes or an hour, that time makes you question, have I lost all of my intellectual property? Am I safeguarding this in the right way? Do I need to come up with a different method for putting something in the cloud, putting something on a hard drive, making physical copies? I think this kind of duplication, it makes sense to trust these big industries, but it also makes sense to pair that with some of your own protocol.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think it's something that we've just taken for granted. I mean, not you, because I would imagine you've thought more deeply about this stuff than the average person, but certainly me and most people I know, there's just a total... a total misguided trust in our ability to rely on these digital spaces to safeguard what is essentially our lives now. Like you say, it can be, I mean, same if I lost access to my online drives, I don't have a physical hard drive anymore. I'm sure there's someone listening to that now saying that and going, what? That's crazy. But I've also had physical hard drives fail on me. I've backed up entire computers. Yeah, I've backed up entire computers, all my teenage photos, which were taken on a, you know, like a digital camera, the kind of thing that kids now buy, like as a kind of retro tongue in cheek thing on Depop.
Yeah, I've seen those.
I took all my teenage photos in one of those and had them all on a computer and I put it on a hard drive thinking again, I was being responsible, and then tried to turn it on, you know, a couple of years ago and it was corrupted or whatever. In terms of like, just back to your point about the inundation of information and sort of like how that's also a way for important stuff to be lost or obscured, that's definitely something I've been thinking a lot about lately. a sort of role of the cultural curator is obviously now become such a big thing, you know, like such an important role in our culture, whatever that is. Even if you're looking at someone like a influencer with an Amazon storefront, like people who are wading through the noise and trying to cut it down for people to some extent. What do you see yourself as a curator in that sense? Like what's your feelings on that?
Yeah. I mean, I think in many ways, because I know so many people who have done like curatorial studies programs or archival science programs or et cetera, I'm very weary of saying I'm a capital C curator or a capital A archivist. But I do think that some of these practices have really boiled over into just how we use online space. Like we're essentially living in an archive. Everything we do is saved in some way. Though, of course, that safety, as we just discussed, is quite nebulous. And when we think about curation, you kind of need to train what is drawing your attention and how to kind of pull those things together. And oftentimes that is then shared as a way to kind of capitalize on this sort of eye or gaze that we've been shaping. The Cyberfeminism Index, I do think in many ways is a curatorial project because it is crowdsourced. There are hundreds of different people who have submitted hundreds of different types of projects and entries, but there's also rules of moderation in place that were set by myself. So while it is open access, it was kind of important to put some boundaries on it, or else it might just include every single type of feminism that's online. When I really don't, that's not my personal definition of cyberfeminism. So I think the curation is important, but it's also important to divulge what the subjective biases of the curator is, rather than treating them as some sort of godlike figure who is defining and shaping these histories.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Going back to something you said earlier about Web 3, kind of obviously there being, you know, we've moved through lots of eras quite rapidly with the internet, and now we're kind of standing on the precipice of a new one, or, you know, at least when it comes to the general public's understanding of how things are going, to, for want of a better word, where what direction they're going in. Obviously, in over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of public anxiety about AI. And, you know, we're all going to be robots is like the most simplistic way of summing up what, you know, we're losing our jobs to AI. And then also that in tandem with what we were talking about earlier with the anxiety about the internet in general and how we kind of feel plugged into a matrix. And unlike for these original cyber feminists, that's not something that we see as aspirational, because again, from what I understand, like, in the early sort of writings and thinking on cyberfeminism, it was almost like it was the sort of disembodying potential of the internet was actually something positive about it, because it might be a way for us to overcome our oppression, you know, for want of a, yeah. And now that seems to be one of the main anxieties about the internet, that it's disembodying us. I don't know if you, how do you think about like the next iteration of the web and AI as it sort of like intersects with these cyber feminist ideas?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really interesting to see these big waves happen, especially in the past several years. So in 2020, we saw this big NFT blockchain boom. Then we see this big AI boom last year, which led to a lot of public anxiety.
And an anxiety boom.
Yeah. These tools have been in the making for decades. Like Marvin Minsky who's considered the father of artificial intelligence, was working on this all the way back in the 60s at MIT Media Lab. The difference now is we have really, really good technology. So all of this lore, all of this initial research has now been expedited, and we're seeing that play out in real time now. But again, if we kind of zoom out and think about other histories of automation, the same kind of anxiety exists across generation. So in our time, maybe it's AI, but previously we also have industrial automation. So a lot of these factory workers, a lot of these craftspeople, their work is really overturned by those factories of automation. The difference now is our factories are linked connectively. So you no longer need like a brick and mortar where people are doing repetitive tasks. We can just outsource all of this labor across the world. And people, companies like Scale AI actually map what the lowest conversion rates are so they can use workers from those countries and pay them a very, very low amount. So this kind of thing, I think, is really disturbing from like the blue collar level. I think the reason why AI anxiety has really spiked in the past year is because for the first time, we have this automation system that is heavily impacting people at the white collar level. So suddenly we have these things like creativity, writing, mathematics, programming, things that you need a college education for in some ways. And those are the things that are being threatened. So it really pushes an existential crisis. All that said, history is kind of a mirror in some ways. Obviously, these things are changing quite rapidly, but we do see legislation slowly coming into place. The technology is a bit faster than it right now, but I do think that there will be safeguards. There will be different types of safeguards across different countries, which I think is maybe the most disturbing part. But in the US and in the UK, we're already starting to see like, what are the ethics of this type of AI adoption in mainstream companies? And what are the limitations of those?
You sound quite calm about all of this. I'm aware that, you know, you're a lecturer, you speak to people about, you know, like it's your part of your job to sort of keep a sense of order in the way that you relate these big shifts. How do you feel about all of it on a personal level? I mean, I'm even interested, forgive me for asking, I'm interested in like what your personal relationship with the internet and social media and all of that stuff is as someone who understands so much, you know, thinks about this on such deep theoretical and conceptual levels, just on a day to day, like what, you know, are you someone who's panicking about your screen time, or are you like very far beyond that kind of that kind of thing?
Well, you know, I had this other conversation with Delia Kai, the Vanity Fair writer, and she's like, do you doom scroll? I'm like, of course I doom scroll. Like, I'm not an internet sage. I am very susceptible to all the things that these applications want us to do. But I think in terms of like calmness, it's not necessarily that I'm calm about the implementation of AI. It's more so that I'm not as worried about it. I'm not more worried about it than global warming, the environmental crisis, the genocides happening around the world. It's like there are so many big ever-present issues. And for whatever reason, AI has really taken our imagination, partly because of the media frenzy and the stories that have been told about it for the past several decades. But all of these things are very interlinked. So maybe that's a more cynical view, actually, not a calm view. But for as much as we're worrying about AI taking our jobs, we could say the same thing about environmentalism and this kind of impact that we're having on our futures.
I mean, of course, that's such a brilliant point. And it is interesting how much it kind of goes back to your point about how when you're inundated, it's impossible to find the pertinent information that you need, and sort of like the media frenzy and overwhelming amount of coverage of the dangers of AI in comparison to, as you say, genocide or the threats posed by climate crisis. It's like, if anything, and again, I understand that they're interlinked, but it kind of, if you had to pit them against each other, maybe it's not even the worst of all the evils. Like when you think, again, these original cyber feminist thinkers saw the kind of idea of the eventual merging of nature and technology as something utopian and like aspirational to some extent.
For sure. And I think, well, I think maybe the problem is that we silo all of these different problems. So instead of understanding that this is a very holistic system that we're seeing. So when people talk about genocide, they assume that that is in one bucket, but that's also very tied to global politics. That's tied to the rights of mothers. That's tied to the environmental crisis. And you could say the same thing about AI. It is going to impact every single industry across the world. And there was going to be an increase of this labor gap, this oppression gap, depending on what region you are in the world, what your demographics are, et cetera. So it's not really about AI versus XYZ other crisis. It's about understanding their interconnections and how we have to really start with maybe understanding the history of these a bit, understanding its actual implications. But I just generally, there's a lot of fear mongering that I think is counterproductive to actually really considering what some of the next steps are.
Absolutely. And I mean, I need to stop bringing this book up in the interviews I'm doing lately, because the listeners will be like, have you been reading Naomi Klein's latest book, Doppelganger? Have you had a chance to check that one out?
No, I haven't read it yet. It's on my list. Yeah.
Yeah. What you're saying really makes me think of a really important chapter in that book, which talks about the kind of overlap between far right online groups and wellness culture.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just in the sense of like both of them ultimately believing in kind of the idea that some bodies are better than others. And then that kind of like they kind of smashed into each other during the pandemic. And obviously that was like, you know, over vaccination in particular, became like a mutual touch point for very different reasons. But it really like helped me to understand or think, or made me think more deeply about kind of exactly what you're saying. Like you think these issues are rooted in, they have so much overlap in problematic, destructive ideologies, but the ideologies are often get boiled down to the same point. And again, in this case, the idea of sort of genetic superiority of some humans over others. And then you could say that there's similar, that, like you say, AI and climate, the forces that have created climate change. They're structural issues, basically, to put it very simply. These are all structural issues, and these are kind of the manifestations of these deeply problematic structures that run our world.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, this Naomi Klein distinction is really important because it also points to this quote by the artist Adrian Piper. I'm paraphrasing here, but she said something like that ideology is a set of false beliefs that's meant to save or protect our comfort. So in this idea of anti-vaxxers, let's say, you might have people who are extreme leftists who are arguing that my body is my temple, and you might have extreme rightists who are talking about, I don't trust the government. But the actual action ends up being the same. So I think it's really important how to map this kind of ideology into practice. I'm writing a paper right now, and there's this writer, Kelly Pendergrass, who talks about how no resource is actually natural, right? Like in the history of capitalism, we see this violent binary emerge between moderns and nature. Capital M, modern. So nature then just becomes anything that might be considered a resource. So whether it's nature itself, indigenous people, women, other people who can be used as laborers in support of the modern man, in quotes. So she then writes like something along the lines of, only through man did coal transform from a rock to a fossil fuel, right? Like we're applying needs, societal needs, onto these miscellaneous resources, and then it becomes heavily extracted and turned into this late capitalist nightmare that we're running in now because everything's heavily privatized. But I think it really just begins to reshape, what do we actually consider a tool? What do we consider a resource? And who is it actually for? Because most of the world are actually used as tools, used as resources. And we're in a very elitist Western bubble that's able to say like, oh, but we're losing all of our resources when we determined what they were in the first place, or have continued to encourage that kind of practice. It's all quite dark.
That's a panic.
But fascinating if you think about it historically. Yeah.
It is fascinating. Like I said, the Naomi Klein book is as dark as it gets, but it is super fascinating. And it is really interesting to think about how all these sort of like dark underground, not even underground, they're very much mainstream, but like how it all sort of reflects each other in this very warped ways, and how it all just sort of like ricochets off each other. And it feels better to at least have someone very intelligent like break it down for you than to sort of deal with the ambient anxiety that comes from sensing all this shit going on and not really being able to name it or articulate it for yourself. You know, but anyway, before the interview becomes too dystopian, there was just one other thing that I wanted to, there's a few other things I wanted to ask you about, but there was one thing sort of, again, going back to wellness culture. And I read another interview with you. I think it was a Pass By interview where you were talking about sort of the idea of embodiment and how you'd, you know, embarked upon various personal pursuits to sort of help you feel embodied after growing up in quite a culturally conservative environment. And I feel like there's a big shift towards, you know, I think wellness culture itself, which has obviously become such a massive, massive industry in the last few years, to me is very much a reflection of our impulse to find a counterbalance to the disembodiment of our online lives. Which is not this, you know, there's like in your personal life, it sounds like it's been really fruitful. And certainly there's lots of levels to it. I'm not talking about the Stanley Cup, Lululemon, you know, top player.
Yeah, of course.
I think in many ways, all of us are trying to get back to that sort of primal embodiment that has been lost by spending however many hours a day on a screen. I just found it curious to read about it as it manifested in your own life.
Yeah, I think that, so I grew up in Orange County, a very conservative suburb of California, right south of Los Angeles. And my parents, they're immigrants. They came and have lived in the same house since I was born. They were very conservative Christians, and that's really how I spent the first 18 years of my life. Like, our social groups were things related to the church. That's what we did during summer break. That's what we did every Sunday and every Friday. And I think that this type of ideological practice is very, very rooted in the body. So even now, I'm able to intellectually dissect like what embodiment means, what mindfulness means, etc. But it's not about thinking, it's about feeling. And this is something that I think I'm a bit detached from. I have a bit of dissociation. But it's also something that, now that I'm aware of it, it's something I can build into my daily practice, however difficult that might be. I think I also very much live in the future. Like, whether it's all the work that you have to do, or all of the new tools that are coming out, or even like the projects that are about to be done, thinking about external validation or all of these factors, these are all outside of the body. And mindfulness is really just about being present. And that's hard to do when you are trained not only to be detached from your body because of very evangelical beliefs, but also because your parents were only concerned about, in many ways, it's kind of an Asian trope, right? To be concerned about what school you went to, certain jobs that you were able to have, this is really for them about safety, right? They want to make sure that their child is stable moving into the future. And these are occupations that have proven that. But that also means that if you're trained to think in this way, you have to untrain all of that, or else you're constantly going to be looking outside of your body for some sort of peace or affirmation. That said, what do I do now to achieve that? I don't know. It's hard. meditation for me has been very, very difficult. I find that heavy, heavy weight training kind of gets me there, because the only thing you're able to feel in that moment is your body trying to lift this weight or whatever the task at hand is. But in terms of like waking up in the morning and having your feet touch the ground, my therapist always brings this one up. I mean, that's hard. I have to remind myself, and then it feels a bit counterintuitive.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard for people who, you know, you've obviously had the additional layer, as you've explained, with this sort of, you know, the specifics of your personal upbringing and in a conservative environment. But I think everyone is struggling with this now, right? Like, this is, again, reflected in the wellness industry, but really just a reflection of a much more human urge to feel something, for want of a better expression.
To be rooted again. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been a bit interested in ergonomics in the past just few days, because UCLA lets me loan different chairs to test them out. So I was curious, like, where did ergonomics come from? And ergo means work. Nomics means law. So it translates to laws of work. And it was basically the idea of building an environment so you were more productive as a laborer, which for me was so disappointing, because I thought it was like, oh, I'm taking care of my body, right? I'm trying to support and maintain its natural mobility. But in the origins of the word, it's actually about efficiency, which was very disillusioning. So who knows if I'll keep pursuing that.
You were back to your efficient pursuits. Yeah, because I know I read that Delia Carr interview with you, which was it's a great piece, and it's very but it's really funny, and sort of talking about all your spreadsheets and your organization methods. You sound yeah. like a very organized person. And of course, that in itself, I mean, even beyond like the incredibly prolific work you do as a teacher, a professor, a writer, a publisher, and all these different things, people, that alone is worthy of, you know, that makes you an aspirational figure, because people really look like, you can see that in these mental TikTok videos of people organizing their fridges, right? Like, I'm always so fascinated by those people who have seven types of ice and or whatever it is. But there's some, I don't know, you probably have more intelligent thoughts on it, but I'm like, what is it about that type of content that is so appealing to people in this moment? You know, what is it about, you know, why did Delia want to ask you about your personal, your rigorous personal organization? And there's something so alluring about people who seem to have a tight lid on things. Well, I don't know what that is. Do you have any thoughts?
That's so funny. Well, it's interesting, because like, I don't actually do it for the sake of being productive. For me, it seems it's almost a bit compulsive. Like, I think it might, I don't want to say OCD, because this is like an actual, mental disorder, but I do think that if I was the closest to any of these, that might be the one. And partly my dad used to say growing up, like, when I went into your room, I could see inside your brain. If your room was messy, I knew you were stressed. And if your room was organized, I knew you were actually doing fine. So for whatever reason, I think this kind of stuck with me. But I have always felt like, as like a kind of multi-hyphenate person and maybe a bit of a generalist, right? Like, not really being a technology scholar, not really being a designer, not really being a curator, not really being an archivist. When I try to think about a skill that I'm actually really, really good at naturally, it just happens to be organization. So I just take that principle and apply it to a lot of disciplines and kind of sort things along the way. So
if you ever decide that you've had enough of being an esteemed academic and scholar, I feel like you would have a bright future as a TikTok storage and organization.
Oh my gosh, I will try that. I only have one type of ice at the moment, but I will expand.
No, I'm joking, obviously.
No, but seriously, one of my favorite things to do is like go to a friend's house. When they say, I need to clean out my closet, I'm like, let's do that now. I will come over and help.
I'm that person.
Help you try things on and sort them out. It's so fun.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's just how your brain works, obviously. You know, it sees order in chaos, right?
Yes, exactly.
Which is why you're able to put together a massive compendium of, you know, links and information, many of which are, you know, like from 20 years ago. Just before we wrap up, I did want to speak to you a little. I mean, you've referenced so many academics. You've like quoted people throughout the course of this interview. So, you know, reading is obviously something you do a huge amount of, and I'm obviously that must be a huge part of your job. What does your reading for pleasure look like, and how do you, you know, it must be quite difficult to, when you're constantly reading for work, what does it look like for you to read for pleasure?
You know, it's funny. I actually really enjoy reading for work. So it, for me, falls in the pleasure category as well. Obviously, I don't actually read fiction at all. I only read essays. And I would like to get into that a bit more. But for whatever reason, like, essays are like a good length for me. I know I can read one in one setting and it feels good. So I actually really love essay anthologies. Reading for pleasure.
It just made me think of a quote from Carl Shaker, who I'm sure you're familiar with, perhaps you even know personally, a great writer on the internet, and also about the internet both. He said in an interview recently, fiction is self-help now. So I thought that was really interesting.
Oh, I like that. I mean, that feels quite apt, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe that's something that you need to lean into a little bit. Not that I love reading essays as well. I'm reading Doppelganger, Naomi Klein's dystopian book about the alt-right mirror world before I go to sleep. So I very much relate, but it made me think, yeah, I need to prioritize fiction. But tell me about some essayists that you enjoy or any anthologies you've read recently that you would recommend.
Well, maybe this is a bit off topic. I actually am almost done with the book Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. He was like a financial writer for, I think, Wall Street Journal or something. The reason why I like this book is I've become so frustrated by the collapse of the dollar, as we're all feeling. It just feels, this idea of a stable future feels very unattainable in many ways. And I think everyone of our generation is feeling that deeply, especially in comparison to our parents. But this book does a great job of kind of unpacking the difference between being rich and being wealthy. So being rich is just money, how much money you're making, whether that's passive or active. Wealth is what you do with that money. So it's really a soft skill or a mindset. Right? It's not really something that you can learn in investing school or business school or et cetera. So what's nice about this is you can basically, or he recommends that everyone define on a personal level what being wealthy means for them. Because once you get to a point, there will always be someone who has more money, even Warren Buffett, right? Even Jeff Bezos. So I think this, in many ways, gave me a lot of peace because it also forces you to be present. Like if you have certain comforts and certain things that make you feel stable now, then in many ways you can slowly but surely aim towards whatever the future looks like, but it doesn't have to be the ultimate goal. So I highly recommend it. It's a very easy read and it's basically a bunch of case studies that all kind of point to this one idea.
I think, as you said, that's a very important reframing as well for our generation in particular, because material wealth is, or riches, is something that might elude a lot of us for even despite our best efforts. And so reframing what wealth might mean. In fact, a friend in LA who's very LA-ish, and I say that as a compliment, but I think you'll know what I mean by that. She was someone who helped me really understand that a long time ago, because I was always panicking about money when I was younger, when I lived there. And she was like, but you're rich, you know, look at the way you look at your life. Like, you get to travel and you get to be around these people with interesting ideas, and you know, you live a free life. And I was like, and that stayed with me ever since. So thank you to that friend. If she's listening, it helped me
a
lot.
Spot on though. Yeah. Yeah. Because Housel really talks about, regardless of how much money you make and no matter how much you actually work, the biggest luxury is time and the freedom to choose what you do with your day.
Absolutely.
And even if you're making a ton of money, if you're working around the clock, that actually maps to lower quantities of happiness across any demographic. Those who actually have a lot of autonomy with their time, they're the people who have proclaimed be happier than people in that same category. So that for me is maybe seems so obvious. But I think it's just a nice way to think about how we can define it for ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
I tend to read multiple books all at the same time, but yeah.
I'm sure. I mean, you must be able to hold a lot of information in your mind, and I'm sure you've got a great, well, actually I've read about your sort of citation system, which is also aspirational to me at least, because I have like all this kind of reading I've done is scattered across about 10 different apps and notes apps and Evernote and Pocket, and oh my goodness, like it's a real mess. I really, if I ever make time to sit down and sort of try and organize my own intellectual archive, that would make me feel very soothed. Because right now it's hard for me to find stuff that I've read, and I'm like, where did I wrote that down somewhere? Where did it go?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not really, there's all these different tools for like note taking and organization, but it's really just about developing like a personal system.
Yeah.
Like you could just use text edit and it would work as long as you maintain some sort of daily practice for that. Though I was talking to a friend recently and he was saying how he wants to start using this new thing, note-taking tool. And I was like, God, that seems so stressful, like data portability and getting all these things in there. And he's like, no, I'm just starting from today. So that might also be a strategy too. It's like, as you move forward, you will only use this as your note-taking function.
Oh, that's an appealing thought.
Because then you don't have to worry about all the stuff in the past. And it feels a bit more energizing rather than it weighing you down.
Like reaching inbox zero by selecting all and deleting rather than going through it.
Exactly. You start from zero.
That's the best way to reach inbox zero, is delete it all. You don't even have to look at it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm sure we're going to have to resort to these measures soon, because again, I mean, as I sit here right now, there's 50,000 photos in my iPhone library alone. So not to mention all the ones that I've, as I told you at the beginning of the interview, have entrusted to various clouds and,
oh no.
Yeah.
I know, it's lost now.
I definitely think I'll get to a point with some of it at some point where I'll just be like, I mean, it's kind of like the relief of losing your phone, right? You're just like, yeah, whatever.
Exactly. You're like, you have initial state of panic and then it feels quite peaceful.
Very peaceful. Just conscious of time. So I just wanted to say thank you so much, Mindy, for sharing, helping me to clarify, you know, some of these big ideas that you grapple with in your work. And I think cyberfeminism is such an intriguing concept, whether you're familiar with it or it's totally new to you. And there's so many offshoots of it which are worthy of exploration. And as I said, for me personally, your own website alone yielded a bunch of links. Also your Arena pages, I like the way that you share PDFs for all your reading, so it's easy to actually access them, because it's sometimes hard to find more obscure texts online. So I appreciate that.
No, thank you so much, Phoebe. This was a great conversation.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I was a bit worried I was going to be in over my head, I'm not going to lie, but you're a good teacher. So you were able to like break it all down for me in a way that I could respond to. Thank you.
No, but I also think that It also, what trying to like reframe certain things also gives clarity to myself. So thanks for the way you've kind of posed these questions. I think that it's also, it helps you think about something in a different way.
What's that expression like? You don't understand something unless you can explain it, which obviously you can explain it in many ways, but to have to explain it to me in like somewhat layman's terms is, yeah, I'm glad it was, I'm glad it was helpful for you too. And I've, you know, when I was doing my research, I was like, compiling a reading list as I went from all these different offshoots that I've discovered. So plenty of food for thought for me. So yeah, I'll let you get back to your busy day. Your prolific output is like I said, maybe we'll have to do a round two with where we talk about all your your time organization techniques, because I'm sure that's like dizzying what you have to do to get it all done, but something to aim for in life.
Oh my gosh, that would be fun. I actually really do love talking about these things, but I wish it was framed just for pleasure and not productivity. Everything's about productivity and efficiency. But yeah, we'll save that for round two.
Yeah. Thank you so much.